Yes, thank you all for coming. Good to have you here. This was a little bit of a difficult one for me because I didn't know quite how far to get into the weeds in a couple of areas. One, Mennonites coming to this area in general and getting started, and two, the whole thing with Hollanders that were about half of when this church started. How much did I really want to delve in? I kind of got sidetracked in the beginning and was really looking at a lot of that, and finally realized that, well, I've got to condense some of that and not get too far into some of that. I don't see Jerry and Carolyn here. I wonder if they headed for Indianapolis maybe. I know he's got a doctor's appointment down there tomorrow. He was going to kind of be my go-to guy for questions on some things if I had them. I do see Lamar Yoder back there, and I will tell you this right now, Lamar sent some files over. I've got one map up here tonight that I'm going to use of his. I have a copy of some of those county maps from the Elkhart County Atlas of 1875, but he had it all laid out and things marked, so thank you, Lamar, for that and the other things you sent. Kenton, I grabbed some pictures from him and also some other files that we'll be using tonight as well. And I know there's others that contribute. So we're going to get started here, the history of Salem. And we're going to start a little bit with the Mennonites of Elkhart County. And Martin Hoover moved here to Elkhart County, hopefully you can see that well, in 1845. Now the Mennonites coming to this area over here around the Yellow Creek area happened around the same time that the Amish moved into a couple of areas. The Amish were just a few years ahead of that. Some of the Amish around Napanee, there were some names down there, but primarily the Amish first really moved in over here by like Clinton area and over into LaGrange County. And that happened, I believe, in somewhere between 39 and 41. I don't have the date right off the top of my head, but somewhere in there. And I mentioned that because the state had kind of opened up and people were moving here. And so it wasn't just the Mennonites that moved in, the Amish moved in as well. And I don't know how much they had any contact with each other. Had the Amish actually settled where they had planned to when they moved here and where they first lived in cabins for a couple of months before they went to Clinton and Newberry townships, they would have actually settled in Boehnertown area. That's where they wanted to settle, and that's where they did. They come back to that. They had found out the year before they came back there. And I've often wondered how that would have affected maybe the Mennonites here on this side of town and the Amish on that side had they been that close together. I don't know if it would have made a difference. But obviously Salem has some what I would call Amish heritage names in it very early, Yoder for one. But Martin Hoover, which, Andrea, do you know how many generations back this is for you? You don't. Okay. I'm assuming this is where your family comes from. He moved here. He was 85 when he made the move here, and his son John moved with him, or maybe I should say he probably moved with John about that time. Martin was the first Mennonite bishop in Elkhart County, from what I understand anyway. And the Yellow Creek Church was built in 1849, and this is one of those areas where I didn't dive into it real far. And maybe someone here can tell me. If you can, I'm open for dialogue tonight. And I do want to have questions at the end. Notice I didn't say questions and answers. I said questions. We'll see about the answers. So I believe the first Yellow Creek Church, I believe, was built a little bit south of where the current Yellow Creek Whistler Church is at, about across from where the Yellow Creek Church of the Brethren is at. And then when they built up where the church is now, I think that old building was maybe moved down here to what was called the Blossers Church, which is just down here at County Road 9, which connects to Salem's beginnings. We'll see that a little bit later. But that was the beginning of the churches there, really. Holdeman was built in 1851. So if you look at this, in 1845, the Mennonites came to the area. By 1849, they were building a church. By 1851, they were building the Holdeman Church, which is out west of Wakarusa, if you're not familiar with that. Then Jacob Christoffel moved to Elkhart County in 1848. Interesting thing about this is I believe Jacob Christoffel was born in Germany, and Martin Hoover, I believe, was also born in Germany or somewhere overseas. It was not native to the United States. So they were both born over there. Jacob Christoffel would be the ancestor of Paul Christoffel, which some of you that are older would know. Lamar, you had some of that Christoffel in there. Do you know how many generations that went back from this one to Paul? A few generations, but but the name Christoffel is where the Christoffel Meeting House comes from, which is directly connected to the Salem Church. He had been an ordained minister in 1827, and he was a farmer and a linen weaver, and about 1850, the Mennonites between New Paris, Four Acre, built a small log meeting house, and it was commonly known as the Christoffel's Meeting House, partly because he was a preacher there, and also because it was on his farm. And when we look at the map, we'll see that a little bit. But I can tell you right now, most of you would know where Dwayne and Bev Martin live, or where Gene and Relita are at. It was basically Catacorny. It was basically right there about where Dwayne and Bev live, possibly a little bit to the east of there, but in that area, because that was the Christoffel farm. If you go down south to the next road, who lives there now? Down straight south of one of the Martins, is it? Donald, yeah. I think that was the Christoffel farm. That piece right there was the Christoffel farm, so at the north end. And just a little tidbit for you that may or may not matter to you, but there were actually a couple of burials on that area. And then later, once the log church was gone, I think they dug up the bodies and moved them over to the cemetery that's straight down the road from us here across from the Maple Grove Church of the Brethren, which is where a number of the people that would have been original people of this church would have been buried. Incidentally, when Gene was talking about the idea of, you know, our heritage is important, but it's more important what we're doing, and I thought about that in connection with our church, and I've thought about this different times. If any of us could go back and walk into this same building, not that many years ago, but especially in the first number of years that those people were here, they wouldn't have a clue who we are. If they walked in here tonight, dressed like we do now, let's say, and looking, we wouldn't have a clue who they are. There's no connection outside of we're part of the same brotherhood worshiping in the same building that they did and trying to carry on what we've been handed, that's been handed to us. But we don't know them. They didn't know us. Now, I don't think time will last this long with the way the world's going. I don't know that, though. But in another 75 or 100 years, if the same thing would happen, if we could come back and walk in the doors, probably the people that would be here. Now, they have pictures, so they might say, you know, I think I saw a picture of that guy one time. You know, this was he. Anyway, but the connection is that we're worshiping in the same place, carrying on the same church that the brotherhood that was started back then and trying to carry it on and be faithful. So it was located on Jacob, he was a preacher as well. We talked about that. It's about 2 miles east of Four Acre. When John Funk preached at Christoffel's in 1884, he reported fair attendance and good attention. That's what John Funk wrote in the Gospel Herald, for whatever that's worth. In 1871, they were having services every 4 weeks. These were the same Sundays as Prairie Street and Shams. Prairie Street's pretty obvious. It's in Elkhart. John Funk would have been up in that area at that time eventually. Who can tell me where the Sham meeting house was at? I would venture a guess most of you have went past it numerous times. Anybody know? How many of you have been past the Olive Church up north of Wakarusa? That's the Shams Meeting House. That's what it used to be called, Sham Meeting House. They were not held on the same Sundays as Yellow Creek or Holdeman's. They kept it on different Sundays so they could go back and forth, and they did do that. If the weather was permissible, they would sometimes travel to one of the other churches for Sunday. Now we're going to jump over to Holland and take a look at the people that came here from that area. And so in about the 19th century, the Mennonites in Holland were losing their stance on non-resistance and other things. So the group that immigrated to the U.S. had actually that church in the Balk area of Friesland had kind of pulled away from the rest of the Mennonites. There were some Mennonites, it was kind of a conference, and there was a guy, they were kind of like speaking for all the Mennonites, and they said, no, you're not speaking for us, and they kind of pulled away. And for different reasons, part of it had to do with just they felt like the Mennonites were getting too worldly, the stance on non-resistance, and so forth. It was becoming hard for them. And Ruard Schmid, the first pastor of this church, I believe his father's name was Obed, and they actually would have translated at their own expense a hymn book at least, and I believe a book on instruction that they used for baptism and so forth, because the other Mennonites in Holland weren't using them anymore, and so they had it translated themselves. They paid good money. The Mennonites in that area, though, had done well financially, which may have been part of the problem. They had become financially successful, and so they were losing out in some of the other areas. If I remember from some of my reading, Obed, the father, was a minister as well, and he was not real excited about immigrating to another area. He felt like their forefathers had suffered and went through trials, and so they could do the same. And he passed away, I think, not long before the ones that actually came here then and moved to this area. So they were losing out there, they felt like, and they were kind of an isolated Mennonite group, kind of holding on to some of the things, and they were called the Fine Mennonites by some, and Old Frisian Church, and different things. But that's what was going on there. They tried to be exempt from military service, sometimes even hiring other people to take their place, but it was becoming increasingly difficult. If you remember right, when we were talking about the history of the Anabaptist, I mentioned that Ruard Schmid's son, that when the Mennonite church was looking for some expansion, that they found him down, I believe it was in Brown County, he was kind of living as a hermit or something, and he got to talking. I think he was pretty happy to say that his father had founded this church, but along with that, his main question was, do the Mennonites still hold to non-resistance? He knew why his family had immigrated here, and so that was a problem. They were also adopting otherworldly standards. A group of Frisian Mennonites from the Netherlands decided to move to America in 1853. This is a map here of Holland and that area, and right up here is the Balk. And this was kind of a hub of a lot of Mennonites. Here's Amsterdam, The Hague down here, Rotterdam, and they were up in this area here. That's where they lived, and that's where they left. And it's interesting, you can read of some of their travels. They give some diary of their travels, somewhat challenging. There were 17 Mennonites who left Balk for America and came here. And among those who moved to New Paris was preacher Ruard Jacobs Simonsmal. Am I saying that right, Wayne? You know, Simonsmal. And wife Elizabeth, and his brother-in-law Ruard J. Schmid, or later Englishized, or whatever you want to call it, to Smith, and his wife Margaret Simonsmal. So those were among the ones that came. And there was a couple different groups that came. It left the group back home. And I forget now the preacher's name that stayed back. It left the group there quite small. There were not many that left. It was a small group when they left. But Ruard Simonsmal died in 1854. And I wish I know for sure what happened. It was just about a year after he was here, he passed away. And one account that you read, it says that he died from felling a tree and had an injury to his knee from an axe and must have got infected. But here, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years ago. I don't know when it was. Cindy, do you remember the date on that information that the guy sent? I don't know. Anyway, there was a Simmons Small visited Salem here. We were gone that Sunday, so I didn't get to talk to him, but he left his phone number. So quite a bit of time went past, and I called him. And by that time, they had moved out to California. And we chatted for some time, and then he sent me a packet. I've actually got it along tonight if anybody wants to look through it. A whole packet of information on the Simmons Small family and Salem and this and that, and a lot of stuff I had and a lot of stuff I didn't. And in there, it mentions about this guy dying, and it just says there, handwritten beside it, died from a blow to the head of the double-bladed axe or something, accidental death. So I don't know if he got hit in the head or if he got hit in the knee, but he died from his axe. Anyway, he was only here a year, and he passed away. They lived on what was called the Dutch Road, which is now County Road 117. So if you go down here to County Road 117 and go down, it's that road that kind of goes down and jogs around there, and that's kind of where they lived. That was kind of called the Holland Road, Dutch Road, and that's where they lived. I think, if I don't blow up the system, well, maybe I'll go through one more slide here before I do that. Yeah, there were Hollanders living in Grand Rapids, Michigan, as I understand, and they had found out from them that there was freedoms in America and there was freedom of religion and you could come here. And the other issue that was over there in Holland was the taxes were really high, taxes were lower here. And so they decided to come. There were also some other Hollanders living in the New Paris area at the time. The group found their way to Jacob Christoffel's farm and stayed there for several weeks. And then eventually, while looking for land, they came across Noah Stump. And I believe Noah Stump may have been like a German Baptist, or maybe they called him River Brethren back then or something, a German Baptist. And so they helped him. They invited him in for family worship. They invited the families in, and they were really impressed with the family worship. And then the group helped Noah build a new barn, and then they were given use of the old barn and housing until other arrangements were made. So they were able to spend some time there, which gave them a little bit of time to build some cabins. At first, they held their services every 4 weeks, and later every 2 weeks. Conducted their service in their own language, and they met in private homes and schoolhouses, and we're going to take a look at those in just a moment, where they were located. They will often meet with the German Mennonites on the other Sundays. Now, a little bit of an interesting thing about this was, one of the things that we know about this whole family and some of the things that happened is Ruard Schmid's wife kept a diary. It's not in English, and I'm not even sure she could understand German very well. Not very well at all. But it's in the historical library in Goshen, and a lot of it's been translated into English, or at least some of it. And so you can read a lot of her story about what happened day to day. As a matter of fact, I think it was out of 1 or 2 Timothy. She actually has in there the first, the first sermon that Ruard Schmid ever preached in Holland. It's in there, and she different passages that she would that would have been in there. And so the Sundays when they worshiped in their own setting with their own people, they would speak their own language, and she could understand. If they went to Christoffel's or they went over to Yellow Creek, it was harder for her to understand what was being said. Ruard could preach in, he understood English, which is one thing that was helpful when they got to the United States and they traveled here. They actually took a spur that, the cheapest route, which entered in Goshen, and so that was kind of the end of the deal, and they got out there and walked on out. But he understood English, which was helpful for the group. And he could also, I think, preach some in German, but he didn't like to. He didn't anymore, and he absolutely had to. As a matter of fact, there's one account of over to Christoffel's meeting house. They were there for services, and the preacher wasn't there and didn't come, and they didn't have a phone, couldn't call him, didn't know why he wasn't there. And it just says that Ruard kept asking the song leader to lead another song and lead another song, and every now and then he'd get up and go look out the window, and he'd go back, and they said one time he turned around and walked away from the window with a smile on his face and says, the preacher has arrived. So somebody came and preached in German, and Ruard didn't have to. So, but So they would worship with the German Mennonites, though, on the other Sundays when they could. It wasn't like it is now. There was one account in her diary where they headed off from just over here at County Road 117, headed off to Yellow Creek. I don't know how far they got, and they saw a thunderstorm coming up, and they turned around and went back home, not going through that. And also, I believe they would hold off services often from late in the year, November, December, somewhere in there, till April. They just didn't have church. It was too risky to be out, cold, blizzards, never knew what was coming. The Blosser Meeting House is the one down here, the old orders at County Road 9 and County Road 46. That's where the Blosser Meeting House was. That particular group, which, from what I understand, never had a large congregation. There were never very many people worshiping there. I already told you where the Christoffel Meeting House was at. And Ruard Schmid's house would have been, cabin and so forth, would have been on County Road 117 down here. And along with that, the Simmons Smalls lived on that road as well. If you've ever been to, and you don't have to admit it if you don't want to, if you've ever been to Amish Acres and ate at the fudge shop down there, went in that little log cabin fudge shop and got something to eat, you were in Ruard Schmid's cabin. Some point they picked it up and moved it down there and selling fudge out of it. That's what I understand. The Swolvland Schoolhouse would have been over of County Road 142, I believe, down by County Road. I think it's maybe 21 or 19, County Road 19. And then there was a Stump Schoolhouse and a Whitehead Schoolhouse more down on like County Road 50 down here. So in 1889, the Mennonites of Union Jackson Township decided to build a new meeting house, and that would have been the spot. It's kind of central, Yellow Creek Blosser, Christoffel Meetings House, and the Whitehead and the Swolvland Schoolhouses, which is kind of what I wanted to show you where those schoolhouses were. The reason those schoolhouses are important is because the Hollanders would meet in those schoolhouses on the off Sundays, like when they were not meeting with the German Mennonites, they would meet in those schoolhouses. And there's a story about the one schoolhouse, I believe it was the Whitehead Schoolhouse, when they were there one Sunday meeting, and somebody showed up and ordered them to not meet there anymore. The problem was, and nobody really knows how or why, but the guy that did it wasn't even the guy that owned the land that the school was built on. So I'm not quite sure what happened. Eventually, they were back at that school. At that point, they went and met at the Swolvland Schoolhouses. It was decided by majority name to name this building the Salem Church, or the Salem Meeting House. Now, this building, it's been added on to a number of times, and I'm not sure I'm going to be able to thought about going through a little bit of some of that tonight, some of the different times it was added on to, but the middle part of this church is still the original 1889 church, the building that was built. It did not have a basement under it to start with. It didn't have some of the ends, and obviously it didn't have that big foyer and all of that kind of stuff, but Paul Christoffel told me that he remembered when they dug the basement out from under this church, the building. And I went back and put the date when I found they had actually done it to when he was born, and he would have been about 7 years old. And I'm sure that was a big deal, 7 year old to see this. And he said they dug it out with mules and slip scoops. That's how they went in underneath and dug this basement out of this thing. A little bit different than we'd do it today. If we'd say, bring your mules and slip scoops, we're going to dig this basement out. That'd be an interesting deal. But anyway, that's what they did. So they built the original building here. And at that time, it was about half Frisian and half Old Mennonite families. Old Mennonite being those from the Christoffel Meeting House, Blossers, which would have been more your German background. The original acre of land that the building was built on cost $5. So you're sitting on $5 worth of land here. Don't forget it. That's a lot of money. Ruard Schmid was the first pastor at the church. I should mention that the first acre here was given by a fellow by the name of Pletcher, who was also a minister who was from Ohio, I believe. And when the whole Whistler Funk split happened, and I probably should have mentioned that, we talked about this in our Anabaptist church history. When the Whistler Funk split happened, Salem would have went with the other churches that didn't go with Whistler, obviously. And there was I think Pletcher was out in Ohio, and there were some things happened there, and he didn't want to be Whistler. A lot of those churches went with Whistler as far as the way they practice, and so he would have moved here and then later gave this land. Later, there was 4 more acres added to this, and I believe that price went up pretty much. I think they paid $100 an acre for those 4 acres. I don't remember because I wasn't here probably when it happened, but I remember reading about it. First minister ordained at Salem was a guy by the name of John H. Baer. I will say this, from what I understand, Ruward Schmid, even though he was considered to be the first pastor of this church and instrumental in helping start it, I believe I read somewhere that he never preached a message in this building. He had the opening, and he'd sometimes have the closing and so forth, give testimony, but I don't know he actually ever preached here because of the time the church was built. And yes. You say Levi Wrestler. Okay. Okay, now you mentioned Levi Wrestler. Okay, one of those wrestlers was one that helped. Well, was he the one that when they received the deed for the first building, or is he the one that helped buy those other 4 acres? Okay. But he couldn't have been the one with the 1889 deed. I thought about that because it's too far back. Yeah, I wonder if it was the deed when they bought the other 4 acres. Okay. I knew there was a wrestler back there, and I was trying to figure out the connection, but I couldn't make the connection all the way back to 1889 because it was too far back. But it must have been when they bought the other acres that he would have been, right? They bought the 4 acres, so he would have been involved. Yes, Lamar?
Levi was born in 1848.
Okay.
One of the first trustees.
Okay. So then Levi would have been Loyal's grandfather, right? Because I thought Loyal's father was born in like late 1800s, right? So would it have been his grandfather? Okay. Thank you. So that is the connection. So the one that was here as a trustee originally that would have been connected to deed. So many of you obviously know Norma Wrestler. It would have been her late husband's grandfather then. Yeah, is that correct, Lamar? Okay, thank you for that, yes. So that puts a little bit of, that kind of narrows up the time a little bit when you think about it, that the connection from today to when it was originally given. So thank you. So yes, the first minister here, John Baer, was first ordained a deacon in 1894 to replace Jacob A. Whistler, who had served the district before transferring to the Napanee congregation. And I don't know that Jacob was necessarily a resident deacon of this congregation, but he was working as a deacon and helping. But then John Baer was ordained as a deacon, and he was ordained a preacher in 1905, and he served for 25 years, which put him up there about 1930. Isaiah Christoffel he replaced John as deacon in 1906 and through 1912 when he served. And Isaiah was killed by lightning in 1912 over on, I believe, that same Christoffel farm. From what I understand, he was bringing his team of horses back up to the barn. There was a storm coming up. And when the horses got to the barn, there was no driver on the wagon or whatever he was using. And they went back and found him. And somehow he had been struck and killed by lightning, and the horses were left unharmed. But he had been killed. Noah Weaver took his place and served until 1926, I believe, when he moved to California. In 1908, services started being held every Sunday. And in 1910, there was an addition to the building, and 2 entrance doors were removed and replaced with 1 double door. So at one time, there were 2 doors back here, and those were replaced with 1 And until 1930, Salem used a tax method to pay for general expenses. Now, how would you like that? Now, if I understand that tax system correctly, that you paid based on what you had to pay at the courthouse for your taxes. So whatever your taxes were at the courthouse, they assessed you similarly. Young men, I think, were supposed to pay, now I'm kind of forgetting this, maybe it was 50 cents or a dollar or something like that, and then later there were some complaints, so they bumped it up to $1.50 or something. And the young ladies were to pay 25 cents if they could. So if you could come up with a quarter, it was nice to help contribute to the expenses of the church, after all. I'm going to go through now the ministers and deacons that were ordained here at Salem. Ray Yoder was ordained minister in 1918, and then he was bishop from 37 to 61. Samuel Metzler was a deacon from 32 to 52. And Francis Freed, brother-in-law and double first cousin to Ray Yoder, was ordained a minister in 1939. Some of you remember Francis Freed by chance? Yeah, there's some of you that do. Yeah. I don't remember him well, but I remember him being here. Harold Myers was ordained a deacon in 1945, minister in 1957, and a bishop in 1960. And Menna Kaufman was ordained deacon in 1962, and I don't actually have the date when he would have completely stopped. He did when Freeman Mullett had went in service in Haiti for a year or so. Menna kind of came out of retirement, came into the ministry, and helped as deacon again until Owen was ordained. And so it was actually, I've considered very privileged to actually work with him in the ministry. So that would have been after 98 sometime that he would have done that. Floyd Stutzman was ordained a minister in 1970, passed away in 1983. After Harold Myers passed away in 1974, Floyd Bontrager served as bishop, kind of as interim bishop from the conference. The conference came and helped get that set up and kind of tried to get involved. And I should, I guess, stop and pause and say this. In the 1960s and 70s, the conference was changing considerably. Salem was not. Ray Yoder was holding back some already when Ray Yoder was bishop. Harold tried to withstand the changes, some of the things that were happening. And through that, because before that, Salem, their youth and their literary, it started out in their youth, would have been a lot with Haldeman and North Main, and some with Yellow Creek. There were quite a bit there together. And when the conference started moving and changing and Salem kind of pulled back, there were a lot of young people that moved with the conference because those were the young people they were running around with. And even after Harold's death and after Floyd Bontrager was in and then Bill and Naaman, there were still some here that were kind of pushing to go with conference and some that weren't. And it was a challenging time, to be honest about it. It was challenging, and I remember some of that. William Yoder and Naaman Martin were both ordained ministers in 1975. So they were ordained ministers in 75. Harold passed away in 74. And so in the meantime, they were thinking about Milford a little bit as well when he ordained too. Bill was ordained bishop in 1977, only 2 years after he was ordained minister, and with no resident bishop here to kind of help with his, I guess, to mentor him. Jerry was ordained deacon in 1986 and minister in 1994. Freeman Mullett was ordained deacon in 94, and I'm not exactly sure what year that would have ended. I was ordained minister in 98, bishop in 06. Owen was ordained deacon in 01. And Dwayne was ordained minister in 07. Of course, both of them have now retired. Kevin, minister in 2013. Tim Stauffer, deacon in 2021. And Gary, a minister in 2022. Now, these next slides, I've got some pictures, and I had a little trouble trying to scan them and get them, and I didn't have a good thing to work with, so they're not going to be ideal, but you'll get a little bit of an idea what some of these ministers look like. This is John Baer. That's really probably hard to see very well back there. The picture itself isn't that great, much less what I got in here. So he was the first one ordained here. There's Ray Yoder, and I have some other pictures of Ray Yoder that we're going to see later, and if I can get the slideshow to work, and I'm a little nervous about that with the way things are going tonight at the computer. This is Francis Freed here when he was quite a bit older. And then this is Harold Myers. Now, I had some, you know what, I never deleted those out of here, so hopefully that doesn't give us a problem. But I actually have some audio here, and this is what I was trying to play and the whole thing, and that's when everything went awry earlier. But I give the files to Gerald, and this is, Kenton was able to get these from tapes that we found up at my mom's. And so I want you to listen carefully to this one, because I believe this is the end of the last sermon that he preached, right? So you're going to hear the last words that Harold preached here before he died of a heart attack shortly thereafter. So go ahead and hit that.
Jesus said, as it was in the days of Noah and the days of Lot, so shall it be in the coming of the Son of Man. And I believe that truly the Lord will come real soon. And are we living daily in this light? Or are we doing like King Agrippa? He said, some more convenient season, I'll call for you. Yes? He put off the opportunity that was his. The opportunity that we have today may never return. Let's take advantage of it, because the Lord will come. And when he takes one that's working in the field and leaves the other behind, which one will I be? Will I be left behind, or will I go to be with the Lord? It depends on the kind of life we live now, what our destination will be when he comes. Shall we kneel together for prayer?
Shortly thereafter. It's kind of interesting how that worked. So I don't know if any of you remember his preaching or not, or his voice, but that was him. I'm going to try to skip past. Here we go. I missed that sound thing. Floyd Stutzman. Probably more of you would remember him, and we have a clip from Floyd as well. So some of you that remember, this brings back memories, and those of you that have never heard these people, it's like, oh, when they talk about Harold or Floyd, this is what they sounded like. Go ahead, Gerald, with Floyd's.
There were some things that seemed like a mountain to me, and many times are things like this become a mountain if we let them. And then I like to say with Caleb, I give me that mountain. I realize that this is a challenge in life. As some people have said, you ought to rejoice. One person come to me just the other day, and he heard I was ordained a minister. He said, if I would be ordained a minister, I would be leaping and shouting, because he thinks that's such a calling. Somehow I couldn't feel this way. Because I look into the Word of God and see the responsibility of a minister, somehow I only by the grace of God will I be able to overcome and be able to be a minister according to the way that God would have us to minister.
I remember my Grandpa Yoder struggled a little bit with Floyd's preaching because he couldn't understand him real well. And I didn't understand that because when I was young, I'd love to hear Floyd preach and he could get going. Yes.
Is the son of you know Katie
Swartzentruber? Yes. Yeah, Katie Swartzentruber, that you might know. This would have been her first husband, Floyd Stutzman, Virgil Stutzman's father. But when I listen to him now, I'm kind of like, yeah, I can see where maybe if Grandpa was a little hard of hearing, maybe his kind of had that accent a little maybe harder to understand. But appreciated Floyd a lot. Floyd Bontrager. Again, he was the interim bishop that came and helped us out for a couple years when we didn't have a bishop after Harold died. And we have a clip of Floyd Bontrager. And some of you may remember him or may not. I remember he was a little older and shaky at the time, but he'd often hold his Bible up and read it and talk. Go ahead, Gerald.
This evening, this congregation has come to this point in their experience. And we have gathered here from far and near, no doubt, as I look over this audience. And I cannot believe that there is any one of us here who have come sort of as a spectator. For I would believe that all of us who know the Lord Jesus Christ are aware of the fact that we need the guidance of the Holy Spirit and enlightenment from His eternal word that we might enter out into the will that He has for us to follow and carry out, so that His work here on this earth might not be hindered, but it can prosper and accomplish that for which He has established it.
That I should have mentioned before, so we could have put that in context. That was actually at Bill Yoder's bishop ordination, was when he was sharing that. That was the message there that he was giving. Actually, that started coming through, that audio right there. That was interesting. Maybe it goes through the HDMI cable after all. This is Ed Schrock. He was not a resident minister here, but he did help assist some and would have helped with some of the, just through the years there from 62 to 67. And D.D. Miller would have also assisted here from 66 to 70. And shall I hit the next button and see what happens? Probably blow the whole thing up. Let me try it. I wonder if you hit it from back there, if it would sound a little bit better. That's not the greatest tape. I don't know.
It's all right, probably. I have learned in whatsoever state I am, therewith to be content. Do we mean that? Is it really true of us? It's good for us to ask ourselves.
Maybe you
can
just cut that one. It's kind of expect a cartoon character coming through with that. Not the best of tape. But it was an old one. It's. Okay. I remember vaguely him being here and preaching some. I like actual visualizing and remembering. I don't remember it that well. So, okay. Okay, this is Naaman Martin. And maybe you want me to try it from here again? It didn't make much difference on that last one. Okay, just run it from yours. Yeah, so many of you would remember Naaman. This would be Owen's father. Go ahead.
The spirit that is holy. He's a spirit of wisdom, a spirit of humility, and a spirit of power, and of love, and of light. Meek. The spirit of God. And so on and on. The lovely hymn, Spirit So Holy. Trust that we might indeed have that spirit this morning, and that God in mercy and love will grant His spirit as we open the word and speak from it, that we all might receive a blessing, that this prayer song might truly become our privilege and part of us today, as it were.
Menna would be Richard's dad, and he didn't preach often, but he did preach some as a deacon. He would preach some, especially sometimes in the Sunday evenings and so forth. And we have a clip from Menna as well.
When I say that I lose friends, I lose friendship. But it's more important that I have a right relationship with Almighty God. and I want your friendship. As Brother Floyd Sitzman used to say, if you want to get into heaven, you have to love me. You may not want to love me because I've said this, but you still need to.
Yeah, I enjoyed Menno a lot through the years. I just put this up here as a note. This is often an extreme shock if you're around beachy Mennonite people or beachy Amish people, and you mention this, they find it really difficult to believe that William McGrath got his start being licensed as a minister in this church. He was not here for many years and then moved out to Ohio, I believe, and was very involved in the beachy circles for years, but he did get his start right here. Going to talk now a little bit about some church planning and some of that, and I think I had talked about this a little bit when we were talking about our Mennonite church history. Salem has been involved in missions as early as 1903. Hattie Fisher was at the home mission in Chicago. And in 1947, Salem started holding Sunday school and Bible school in Toto, Indiana. And I believe that was because, again, the conference was looking for places, and maybe Salem was asking where would be a good place. And they found Toto and decided to have some Sunday school there. And Harold and Rosetta would have been down there for a while helping build that building, I believe. In 1952, Jancy Hirschberger was ordained a minister at Toto. In 1971, Salem started services in Milford, Indiana, and this would have been kind of a mission to the Spanish-speaking people there. And I know that for us today, we say Spanish-speaking people there. I mean, we kind of live in a community where you go to a lot of stores and you hear a lot of Spanish being spoken. But at that time, there were not. Milford was kind of the hub of Spanish people in the area, and so there was somebody that was interested in us being there. The Milfords and the ministers and deacons ordained at Milford were Ben Shirk, Art Hirschberger, Amos Raymer, and Dale Swartz and Truber. Later, Milford became an independent brotherhood, and then after some things happened there, Griner kind of took them under the wing, and I think they're back to being pretty much on their own at this point. In, boy, that's important. I'm not sure what happened there. I think I know what it was. I was trying to find out when we started the children's ministry, and I never finished it. Somewhere in the 2015 to 2016 in there is when we would have started the children's ministry in Goshen. 1981, Salem officially withdrew from the Indiana Michigan Conference. Salem currently affiliates with the Anabaptist Mennonite Fellowship. Is who we would currently fellowship with. This picture right here is Ray Yoder and his wife and Ruth Christoffel. So this is another picture of Ray Yoder and his wife and Ruth Christoffel here. And a bunch of youngins.
And that's at Salem or where?
That's at somebody's house right there. This here is at Salem, though. This picture is taken out back of the church with a group of young people looking there. And I've got quite a few of these, so I'm going to move through them. This is also a picture of Ray Yoder, a bishop that was here for a number of years. And this is Harold and Rosetta Myers in their home. Harold was our bishop that passed away in 74. That's his wife Rosetta, which she would have been here for a number of years. Many of you would have remembered her. This is in our church basement down here with the primary class. And again, it doesn't show up quite as well up here on this screen, but you kind of get an idea there of the primary department. Can anybody tell me who any of these children are?
They're really good looking ones.
Well, Leroy, that either better be your wife or you're in trouble, one of the two. That's Carolyn right there. Yeah, that's a Snyder girl there and a Whetstone there. Oh, yes, that's Susan right there, Susan Pletcher. I'm not sure, I think Susan's here, but yes. There are a lot more of these pictures around, but this is a picture of inside a church, in the back of the church at one time. I better keep moving here. This is an older picture of the church looking from the south end up toward it. And if you're a youth that's my age, or were a youth when I was, kind of remember some of that as far as how that looks back there. There's a picture of the front of the church back when there were some trees and so forth. By the way, there used to be a big row of maple trees, I think, over on this side of the church, way back from what I understand. And one of the, there was a buggy shed too. And I thought I had a picture somewhere of the buggy shed, but I couldn't find it. And it was, what's that?
East side or the west side?
It was over on the west side, I believe. And these maple trees, I guess one of the stories I read that they leafed out one summer looking nice and some disease hit them, they all died. So took care of that. How many of you remember when there were trees out over here in the parking lot? Not very many of you. Now, there were a few trees out in the middle of the parking lot. That worked out real well. Drive over their roots long enough, they'll die. Well, another picture of the building itself on the front side. You can see, and you can kind of see right there where some of the original, like the foundation from the original building to the addition. Yes? That is the south side. You're right. It's the south side. Yep, thank you. That is as well. Getting ready there to do some work on it. There's the front side of it. Another picture from that angle. And this is for looking down from the balcony, back when we had one, before we switched things around. And there is the balcony, as you can see back there, which would have been right up here, where you're looking. And there you can kind of see the rooms that used to be out, well, the way it was, it would have been back there, actually out in the front there. And used to go up through the one here for a council meeting, if I remember correctly. Went up through here and then would come back through this here after we were done. There's the back of the church, the old mailboxes that would have been back here. And the double doors, which would have been right in here. Okay, and this is where you youth don't understand this, but this is down in the basement. And so you're looking toward the doors that go into the new section, but this is the stairs that went out. The MYF always used to meet down here for our services, and this was where we just kind of hung out up in this area, just kind of took over the stairs and hung out there and spent a lot of time there. This was adding on to the building and some more of that. Here's another picture of the basement and the area down there for the primary department. This is a picture outside of the church. People used to go out the front door and kind of hang out there. Get my mouse out of the way here. So I think that's the same picture. Some of you do not remember this, obviously, but before we had the fellowship hall, if we wanted to have a carry-in dinner here at the church, we did it all in the basement with that huge kitchen down there and a huge setup. And so that's a picture in the basement, and there we are. We would eat at every table we could possibly find down there, and then a few more that we'd set up. And now you're starting to look at people and wonder who all's who all, right? I think this is my father-in-law right here in the corner, Lowell. And there is a very young Roman Hostetler right there. I believe, right, Roman? Yeah. And there's Dale Schertz's son. And I don't know who this guy is. Francis Yoder back here. Yeah. And here's some more setting up of the tables and down the basement. And this is where we would eat. So where we'd have our dinners. This is a picture here of the church way back. And you'll notice two windows here, which, again, were turned around, would have been back there. But it was before there was an addition on behind that, before the couple of rooms were added on. Like I said, there were a couple of remodeling jobs here, one around 1960-something, I think, and then one earlier. Notice the benches here are the slotted benches. I think I got another picture of those. Incidentally, to start with here in the church, the benches were solid, just solid board benches, just whoosh, and I don't remember them. I didn't sit on them. Not in that state, I didn't. But then at one point, they decided they wanted more of a contoured bench, and so they brought in a big old, I don't know if it was a gas-powered sawmill or something, tore the benches apart, and right here in the building, and ran the slabs through and cut them down to size and put a little angle on them, put new uprights and use the same wood to build new benches, and that's what those benches are. And when we first started coming to church here, we were using those benches, and if I remember right, my mother was always afraid we were going to get our fingers stuck in those slats. Probably happened. That's probably why she was worried about it. There's a picture, a very similar picture, after the doors were put in, so it was obviously after the addition. And I think Rosetta may, I'm not sure who gave me these pictures, maybe Rosetta, she's got a question mark there, 1940 with a question mark. You'll notice those chairs, though. And that's the same chairs that we're still sitting on up here. Those chairs were in other parts of the church for a long time when there was a bench here. And then those are back here. I think maybe Ken took those and had them refinished to match more here. And if I remember right, one of them left your pickup truck. And they're pretty sturdy. They can go down a county road bouncing like crazy and survive. That picture didn't turn out real well, but that's Harold up there preaching on a Sunday morning. And there's another picture of Ray Yoder. I think that's that same group with a little bit different angle. There's another picture of the church from the front there. A little bit older picture. No, it does. Yeah, right out over here somewhere. No, I think the one that we cut down was back there. It was right out here by the corner. Oh, I thought you said it is. I'm thinking, man, I am missing something, folks. Yeah. Well, north, no. Northwest. Yeah. I don't know. I don't remember that tree myself. There's the one back there that I remember, but I can't quite remember that one. I thought this was interesting, the modern automobiles there, all backed up to the church. And, yeah. There's another one that would show that tree. There's a picture of the trees turning. A lot of these are similar, but I just left them all in here for you to look at. That's after the addition put on, south end there. That's when the bench was back here instead of the chairs. That's so if one of the ministers was too boring, the other one could kind of lay down on the bench. And I started preaching, they took it out. Too many of them were napping up there. Actually, I think that bench was still there when I started. Now I'm starting to question myself a little. Here's a picture before things were turned around again. This was in the basement, one of the classrooms down there, the library. Some more outdoor pictures. I'm not sure about this tree right here either. Is that the one we just cut down? Tree up here is gone, though, in this picture, I think. I don't know. Another interesting study, if you want to take all these pictures and put them together and start looking at where the windows are located, I don't know. I think they just moved windows sometimes because they wanted to move a window or something. I don't know. They're not all the same. Well, some of these almost look like we've seen them before. Whoops, that's got that tree in there. Maybe that's the same one a different time, I don't know. Here you can see one again, it's just the windows up front and the old slatted benches. I think, let's take a look at this one again. I think that's that little table that's in the back here. Is that an alarm clock on it? That was before my time. Yeah, I think they did. It was hard tile floor, wood floor, tile floor, or something. This is when, this is a good picture of that back when you just had the windows, no doors and that before the addition, and the slatted benches again. With the amen corners as well. Yeah, that's true. You didn't have the doors, so you could sit them right up close. Well, let's see here. We need to get moving through these. There's another one in the basement. There's another picture down in the basement. This was, again, after the doors were put in, so they cut down on the amen benches, probably. And there's a picture of the balcony. A picture after the new benches were in at that point. And here's a picture of the youth. Some of you might be able to pick out people. You know, there's Francis and Freeman Yoder. I think that's Dale Weldy and his wife Nora, which would be a twin to Bill's wife Laura. Paul Berkey's son. I think that might be a Berkey. I don't know. Some of you can probably pick it. There's Harold right there, Harold Myers.
Would that be Paul Berkey? Not his son? I think that's Paul.
Well, maybe it is Paul. Yeah, could be. Youth sponsor or something. There is a newcomer.
Right beside Francis there, that's Carol's sister, Lois and Mary.
Oh, here?
And Irvin is in there somewhere.
This one?
No, to the left.
Right here. Oh, there. Oh, wow, I don't know. That goes back a ways. Okay, I think that is all of those, I believe. Okay, I think due to the time, I guess you all can look at that if you want to. That's not Salem. Doesn't even look like Salem. But there it is. It's 8 o'clock. There's some other interesting little facts that we could read about the church, like when the youth would have started way back, and Sewing started many, many, many years ago. Salem has been doing their 4th of July get-together for many years, and there's actually a list of where all those were held. That's been going on, I think started out at Ray Yoder's house. A lot of unique things like that. One little tidbit I came across somewhere, I don't know, maybe it's in that anniversary book that Wayne and my folks and some others helped put the history together. Is it in there about the ladies when they went to sewing, tying their sewing machines on the side of the car?
I think so, but I can't put my hands on
it. I read it somewhere in somebody's history back then. You remember the old treadle sewing machines that you do with your feet? Some of the people's cars, they couldn't get them in a trunk or whatever, so they'd tie them on the side of the car and go to the, and they'd have sewing at one of the people's houses, and they'd all show up there, the ladies. I wonder how many ladies today would want to tie something like that on the side of their car to go to sewing. Probably wouldn't work very well. But they wanted to do it, so they went and they'd had sewing that way.
We did one of the remodels. We met at Union Center School in the gym during that remodel.
And now that's where, yeah, we have that building now, so yes. And I was going to put in here, in that same page, I was going to put in about the when the children's ministry started, I was going to put when we started our school. I didn't get that in there either. Yes, we met over there do you remember how many Sundays that would have been?
That was a number of Sundays.
Yeah. For church, yeah.
Yeah, one thing, you talk about the ministry, I thought some of the youngers might find it interesting. Harold Myers was one of the, he was the minister and bishop at the time, and he was a big pusher for to put the cemetery up.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I don't remember, but it's just within a couple hundred feet here, that's where he died from the church. He was riding a tractor and had a heart attack on a tractor and ran into the pole. But then Harold was actually the first one buried in our cemetery. Yeah. And I remember Rosetta really struggled with that because that was hard for her. Mm-hmm. But Harold was a big
yeah, he was a proponent of that. Yeah. I think prior to that, most of our people would be buried at maybe Yellow Creek or up at Oliver, one of those cemeteries. And so he felt like we should have our own. And yes, thank you for mentioning that. He pushed for that, and he was the first one buried in it. Wayne, was your daughter the second one buried in the cemetery out there? I was reading a little bit of that. Yeah, not long after. Maybe it was not the second, but very early on would have been one of Wayne's daughters was buried out there. Okay, anybody have some questions or something you want to share? I know there was a lot of maybe things that, if you like the history of the church, we kind of went over or missed because trying to get everything done tonight. Hopefully I tied together a little bit of the whole background of where people came from to hear. I will say, there is one thing I didn't mention, and then I'll get you, Leroy. It was not, I don't know what year it would have been when the last Hollanders were part of this church. And there's none of those. So those names that would have come over would have been names like I mentioned, Schmid, Simmons Small, Darkwood. It was spelled differently in the old language. Darkwood, Fisher, Heidemall, Postman. There was a number of different names, and no descendants here at all in this church. I asked Paul Christoffel one time, I said, Paul, what happened to all those people? Why'd they leave? And Paul said, well, he said he felt like it was some Amish influence coming into the church and there was just differences in how they did things. I wouldn't have thought there was that much Amish influence back that far unless he was referencing like maybe Ray because of him being a Yoder. I don't know Ray Yoder's background. I'm not sure what it was. Or it would have seemed more likely to me that it was the differences between the German Mennonites and the Holland Mennonites and how they would have done things. But in talking to someone at the curator up at the Mennonite Historical Library, I was talking to him one time and I asked him about it. And I don't remember for sure. I should go back up there sometime and ask him. I don't remember if it was him or someone he knew well had actually, some years before, visited with one of the older Simmons Small descendants or ladies in the community. And her take on it was that there were other Hollanders in the area as well. And as their children got older, they tended to associate with them, married them, and just left Mennonite church altogether. That they, many of them did not stay in the Mennonite church because of just their people. A lot of the other people that were from their home country were not Mennonites. And so I don't know exactly what happened, but I think it's kind of sad. I wish there were some of those descendants still here and part of us. That would be really, really neat if that would have carried on down. Yeah, I actually even went to school with a Heidemal over that lived over by New Paris and Darkwoods. There's Darkwoods that lived just down here at one time. Yes. Yeah, is it in there?
Regular sewing meetings once a month for Galton Homes. This is an interesting bit of information about these early meetings, is that the women tied their kettle sewing machines on the side of their cars when they went to each other's home for the sewing day.
Yeah. Yep. And that, if you have one of those history books, or one of those books, that was the church directory that was when we turned 100 years old. There's a lot of information in there, and a lot of that comes from some other sources, but Marie Yoder, who would have been Ray Yoder's daughter, wrote up quite a thesis, I think, for a college paper or something on this church. A lot of information in there, especially about those coming over from Holland, and there's other sources, too, that reference that whole Holland group. And very interesting, but again, like I said, to try to focus a lot on that, I kind of wanted to head in that direction, and finally I was like, got to pull back somewhere. Leroy, you were going to say something.
Yeah, you talk about Simmons Walls. Growing up over there where Wayne and Brett now live, there was a Simmons Wall that lived just south of us, so about half a mile.
Okay.
And that's kind of the last Simmons Wall that I've ever heard in the area, and passed away. I think David lived there. But I have a question because there's a lot of discussion about this. Do we have anywhere in the archive record of when Salem started at Midas?
You know, of all the different things I read about, I read where we started, like our youth things. I know I've seen them like that, the literary, some of that other. I don't know if I've ever come across a date for the first five.
Yes.
My mom was one of the first classes, or maybe the first class, to come to Bible school when she was 4 years old.
Okay.
So.
And what year was she born?
1943.
Okay. So it would have started at least then in the mid-40s, prior late mid to late 40s. Late 40s maybe. Thank you for that, Andrew. So, there you go. We've been doing it a while.
Andrew, did you say your mom was four?
She was four, yeah.
So, if she was born in 43, that means it would have been 47.
Yeah.
Dakota started in 47, what you said. I find that interesting.
Yeah.
So, maybe they started at the same time.
Good. Somebody might have said, well, if we're going to go down there and start a Bible school, why don't we do one?
It sounds like something maybe a Mennonite would say, you know. So. I don't know. That's a good. That would kind of correlate, though, that whole thing. Interesting.
She said they had Ritz crackers and juice, and she thought it was so good.
Oh, wow. Better put some cheese and sausage with that Ritz crackers, maybe. thank you. That's interesting. Yes, Catherine?
Salem actually joined the Indiana-Michigan Conference. You kind of...
Like, yeah, 1889. Okay, so... Yes, they were just part of the Mennonite church in this area. And I don't know... I'd have to look that up. Maybe one of you know exactly when it was became officially the Indiana-Michigan Conference. I don't know. I know that the Amish Mennonites over on the other side of Goshen that started from the Amish church when some of those started building church buildings, that's when the division happened there, and they called the one the Old Order Mennonite or the Old Order Amish, and the others just maintained the Amish Mennonite name. And I believe it was in 1916 when those that maintained the Amish Mennonite name and built church houses like Forks and Clinton Frame and those would have joined they joined the Mennonite church, and I assumed it was the Indiana Michigan Conference, but maybe it was still just called the Mennonite Church. I don't know.
I think that's when the Indiana Michigan Conference started.
Okay. Okay, so that would have been 1916 then. Okay. So at that point, then Salem would have just automatically been a part of it because all these churches over here were part of the Mennonite Church. So good question, though. Yeah, thank you, Lamar. Okay.
It seemed like when they started, they would only meet once every month or something so that they could go to other churches. I was just wondering how they, apparently they all felt like they were all one big community. And do you know anything more about their structure and how they made that work? Or was it just, maybe there wasn't much?
I don't know a lot of details, but I would say it would be similar to
maybe what you see in Whistler Mennonite Church today, where ministers will, like they're all part of the kind of the same conference, and so one could be here or there. They do have, the ministers there now do have their home churches, so they don't rotate quite as much as they did. And there would have been home ministers even back then. But I think it was just kind of one big group, and they just all were under the umbrella of everything. And I think they worked closely together. And then once they started having conference, some Indiana Mission Conference and so forth, I think the conference would oversee some of the things to where one church didn't just do this and another church this and the other until in the 70s when they kind of put it back to the churches to be more autonomous.
Well, the Amish churches today still practice that. I thought that when you was kind of blown through that, say, meet every other week.
Because the Amish church, a lot of districts, most districts just have church and Roman can back me up and, or tell me I'm wrong, but my understanding is my Amish friends, it's like every other week. And then the other way, people visit other businesses.
Yeah, they can, yeah.
If they want to, yeah. Yeah. Yes, Lamar?
I think a lot of that, not having church every week, back in the day, it was weather, it was horse and buggies, and there were no paved roads. And you just didn't go as far as often.
Yeah.
And that's why you had the Christoffel and the Blosser that were really satellite churches of Yellow Creek for people that lived a distance away. And there was the county line church, too. So.
Yeah, there was a county line church. It was, today,
you're right, Lamar. Today, with the vehicles and everything we have, if the same number of Mennonites would be in Elkhart County, they'd have probably had one or two churches at the most. What would be the point? But back then, like you say, it was hard to. Yeah, like I said, that one time Rewards headed out to Yellow Creek and they saw a thunderstorm coming and they hightailed it back home. It was different. So yeah, I think you're right. And then in the winter, they just didn't go out as much. Just didn't have church. Stay at home on Sunday and read the scripture and not work, and probably grow as a family and that. And yeah. Someone else, a question or something that I totally missed with Salem. Some of you that are more into Salem history, so what did I overlook here that should have been said? There was one thing I was going to ask. How many of you can just raise your hand? How many of you here tonight were born and raised at Salem? bunch of the youth. Jerry asked me a question, and he's not here this evening. He had asked me a question when I was over visiting him here a couple weeks ago or so. He said, who was the first minister that was actually ordained at Salem that was born there? And I thought he was thinking maybe it was Kevin, but I'm not sure about John Bear. I'm not sure if he would have been born a part of this church or not. But I told Jerry, I said, well, if it was this late, it wouldn't have been Kevin. It would actually, I would have been born here. But it's hard to believe it would have went that many years to have somebody actually ordained as a minister here that was actually born in this church. But I don't know. Serenus would have been. Serenus Bear would have been probably because his dad was John. So Serenus probably would have been, if John wasn't, Serenus Bear would have probably been. So there's one. So, but some of them would have been coming from other churches. Okay. I don't have a whole lot more. That's kind of our beginnings. Half German, half Dutch. There we are. And well, we all are, for sure. If anybody wants to look through any of the other stuff I've got up here, like from the Simmons Smalls or something, or I think I even maybe brought along the book that probably has your name in it, when you were born, when you died, and when you joined church, those kind of things. It's all in there. I might have that up here. Be really careful with that. It's been around a while. There was a book I almost brought and I didn't, that John Bear actually, they had better handwriting back then, and he kept a few records back way back, and he, inside the cover here, he wrote stuff in there, like kind of the title of it, really fancy English. And then when his son Serenus Bear donated to the church, he just took a ballpoint pen on the same page and wrote, "Donated to Salem by Serenus Bear." I'm like, why did you put that on a sticky note? It's all there anyway. Okay. Well, I hope you appreciate a little bit of that and appreciate your heritage. But like Gene said, all that history doesn't do us any good if we're not faithful to the Lord and Savior till he comes again and comes for us. And someday, someone may be up here giving a history and say, how many of you here remember that preacher Terrell Yoder? That might be a couple of old folks. I think I do. Don't remember what he sounded like. Remember he was bald and talked a long time. That's about all. Okay. Thanks for coming, and hope you, maybe learn a little something new. Let's stand for a closing prayer.